Online professionalism. What does that even mean anyway? Well, today I'm joined by Rory Lees-Oakes again, and this time we have a discussion about technology and where we might be in a world of cancellation and the movie Falling Down. Might we be perceived like Michael Douglas was in the film? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. Listen in to find out. And enjoy this week's conversation.
So today I'm back with Rory Lees-Oakes, and I don't know what we're going to talk about this time, but it is definitely going to be technology and how that can apply to professionals, particularly as both of us are in the realm of psychotherapy and counselling, and I'm going to put in brackets psychology. Where are we at with today's changes? Last time we spoke was about online professionalism. And of course, you have written a chapter for the book that's coming out by the time this podcast will be out around online professionalism. So where do you want to start today, Rory?
Well, I think, you know, I think we could just touch on the chapter in the book, because yeah. I think that it's the right time. You know, Kath very kindly asked me to write a chapter on online professionalism, mainly because I think my company counselling tutor, bit of a plug for my company here, run a extensively large Facebook group. I think there's about 55,000 people in it, and we have to moderate it. And also our company run online and telephone counselling training. And within that training, we talk about disinhibition effects. And disinhibition, of course, is the work of John Sula, an American psychologist, who really talks about how people behave online. I think he was probably talking more about gaming. The theory is quite old now in terms of internet.
Yeah, 2004.
2004, so that makes it positively ancient in the terms of the internet, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And how people may say things online when they wouldn't say them face to face. And not only that, the consequences of that. And I gave three examples, one being, of course, Jordan Peterson, who is, I believe, being censured by his professional body, Dr. Jordan Peterson, love him or hate him. And he's being censored by his professional body because of things that he said online. And they've asked him, I believe, to undertake social media training. And he's making a big hubbub about that, isn't he?
Yeah, in air quotes, training. He's made a very interesting remark about that, about who the hell is going to, so these are his words, almost verbatim, who the hell is going to teach him about communicating when that's his job?
Yes. Yes. And you know, I think even the most astute mind can, can say things that appear without context and get people into trouble. I think the difficulty with social media is that, Twitter or X, as it's called now, has changed. It used to be 140 characters, I think. And now it's a lot more of a long form text platform. Mm-hmm. However, I think that people say things, and sometimes they're just streams of consciousness as opposed to a thought out and rational response to something. And there's a consequence to that. They can be misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes people just type it out of awareness, and it can get a lot of people in trouble. And there's, you don't have to read the popular press to see the kind of folks that have got in trouble over the years. You know, be it MPs, be it members of parliament, be it, people in business who've tweeted stuff, and they've had to find that they've tweeted in haste and they've repented at their leisure, as I mentioned in the book.
Yeah. And I think what we're alluding to with this online professionalism is that, now I know I brought this up at a recent conference where I was talking to some psychotherapists and counsellors, and I said, what do you think about the fact that we are in the public domain, I'm going to use terms here which are quite visually descriptive, throwing around our opinions, throwing around our professional, so there's a lot of this that occurs as well, our professional sessions in terms of what happens there, And there's a big therapist in America that does this quite a lot, that gets challenged quite often. But there's this idea about, I asked some therapists, what's your opinion about us doing this? And the fact there is no longer any privacy for us in terms of being a therapist, because we're not following, let's call it the 1950s model, where somebody would pick up a phone connected to the wall, ask us for an appointment and wander around to our clinic, because now they can do research on us. They can have a look at our profile. They can see the kind of political leanings that we've got. Now, I think that was really what we talked about in season one. And this is now season four of my podcast, which has had a big break. So this is 5-6 years down the line.
Yeah, absolutely, Kath. And it's a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, what you're talking about is free speech and the ability to speak freely, which we cherish in a democratic society. Mm-hmm. And how that free speech may impact on a client. I'm pretty clear in my own practice. Other people can take their own view. I keep my opinions to myself unless I need to thoughtfully speak out on something. You know, I mean, recently we've had parking charges in the village I live, and I've spoken out about it and said I don't believe it. But I'm not, you know, I've not gone off in a very kind of child ego rant. You know, I've just put a case to it. And also, I'm very thoughtful about the images that are available on social media. So my Facebook profile is a means to an end. I have to have a Facebook profile to run the group, but it's locked down. And I actually don't use Facebook. Just don't use it.
Well, it's the most rubbish of all the platforms, foshes.
Well, there we have it. Because you know, no one wants to know what I'm having for breakfast. And before anybody scrolls through the council and tutor timeline and sees a picture of me eating my breakfast, you know, I've revised my opinions through the years. And I also think we live in quite a political I don't think our personal politics now generally are small p. I think they're a large p. And people are very, very divided. We only have to listen to the voices regarding the conflict in Israel and in Gaza, or Gaza and Israel, to see where the people are falling on different sides of the line. Gender ideology is another one. And I think that what we have to remember is, as professionals, this is my view. I mean, other people could take their own view. As professionals, we need to paint quite a blank canvas for our clients for two reasons. One is they're not here to know our political views. I don't think they're here to get help. You know, they come for things like loss, grief. They've been abused. They've lost direction in life, and they want to come in and see someone. And also, I would feel uncomfortable, shall I say, if someone came to me because I had a political view. I'd feel a little bit uncomfortable about that, because they may want, because just because you have a political view doesn't mean you're actually aligned. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of people
overlap, nuance.
So I prefer to keep my opinions between myself and the ballot box, and you know, when I worked as a therapist, I mean, I'm retired from active therapy now. I provide kind of a place where people could come and they could share all their opinions. My fear would be that if I were to be overtly political, then a client would be frightened of voicing their views. And once we start to do that, we're really shutting clients down, you know. And I'll even be more bolder. If you want to be a political campaigner, do that. Do that. Be a political campaigner. It's worthy work. If you want to change the world, it's worthy work.
Yes.
I'm not sure for me, and I don't speak for anyone else, how compatible it is with being a therapist, because I think that you may get, I'll give you a really good example. I don't know if anybody's watched the film Falling Down.
Michael Douglas.
boy, have I had days like that. And it's a story of a man who's kind of losing control of himself. He wants to get home to see his daughter's birthday. And he obviously has an anger management problem. But he's been estranged from his daughter. And it's the story of his journey to get his daughter's present. And within that, he has a lot of conflict. And at one point, he goes into an Army and Navy store. This is an American-based thing. And the guy who runs the Army and Navy store is, for want of a better word, a Nazi. He's definitely a Nazi. And he says, you're just like me to Michael Douglas. You're just like me. And the difficulty is Michael Douglas isn't a Nazi. He's just someone who's very angry with the world. And I think the difficulty, you know, if we take that idea of a breadth of opinion about things and then put that into the therapy domain, what may happen is that someone comes in and says, oh, I've seen your posts on social media, and, you know, and then goes on to say, well, I'm a Nazi, actually, and you agree with me. Where do you go with that?
I mean, the reason we wanted online professionalism so let's just do a little pricey about the book. The book that's coming out is called Cybersecurity and Data Protection for Professionals. And of course, the way that online professionalism gets tied into that are those very conversations that I alluded to at the beginning, where people are discussing, you know, this is what I did with my client today, or there's a large number of professionals that will be chit-chatting about what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the two, I'm going to call them the two approaches that I've found when I ask the question about online professionalism and what do you think we should do? What do you think we ought to do? What do you think we should not do? You know, the kinds of critical parent language for a lot of people. There is this thing about the people saying, well, I should be allowed to say exactly what I want on social media because I'm a human like everybody else. And therefore, you know, if I want to promote what I've been training people on, or I want to talk about the kinds of things that I work with, then that's my right to do so. Versus the, and I don't want to call it opposite because I don't think there really are opposites in this space. I think the ulterior or alternative, should I say, is, well, actually, you have to think about what you want to be dealing with in the therapy room. So I, as you know, because you do a podcast as well, and so do I actually have it within my contract with my clients, and I am a child therapist as well as an adult therapist, that people may find my podcast online. The podcast is about online behaviours. It is about online technicalities. It's about data protection, cybersecurity, pretty much all things technology. But it also says to the clients within the contract that I'm not going to engage with them on social media for a number of reasons, but the podcast is about my research. It is about what I'm writing about. It's not about anything we're doing. It's not about the fact that I'm going to talk about my clients online. And that's a distinction I've had to try and make, but certainly with you referencing politics and kind of leanings around the big C thing that happened in 2020, that none of us are allowed to talk about.
No.
And actually what happened during that time was there was a lot of personal reflections and opinions. And personally, I think people are entitled to say what they want. And it kind of did help me filter down my friends list very quickly, that's for sure. But also, there is something about what happens if your client sees that. What does it then prevent, as you're discussing, what does it then prevent, or what does it promote in the therapy office?
Yeah, yeah.
What will a client take from their misunderstanding about something that's called a parasocial relationship? So they see you online, they make an assumption, which people will be doing about us if they don't know us personally. And then what would they say in the therapy room? And I don't really see much of this being talked about in the therapy trainings. I don't really see conversations taking place about these nuances.
No. And what you're speaking about, of course, is the Overton window, which is the basis of free speech. And Overton was a person who identified what is acceptable to talk about in a free society. And I think it's always going to be a interesting dynamic, balancing the rights of free speech with balancing the rights of being a professional. And I think that, you know, from a client's point of view, if you put yourself in a client's shoes, a lot of clients follow their therapist. We know this.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing, you know, I have software on my computer. So, you know, the amount of questions that's asked Google about me is interesting. Someone actually asked if I was married and which I thought was quite interesting. Don't know why someone wants to know that, but
I'm kind of going, what would that be about?
Well, I've no idea. Maybe they were just interested, and I guess the whole point is that if we are going on and we're asking questions to a group of anonymous people, so. You know, mm-hmm. I might go on and ask how to repair my washing machine pipe on a Facebook group of plumbers. And my washing machine's leaking. What do I do? And you get a variety of opinions. And let's face it, the washing machine's pretty benign. The worst you're going to get probably is a wet floor. I mean, if you talk about water, you could get electrocuted, I guess, if you talk about electricity. But the worst that's going to happen, you're going to get a wet floor. And, you know, if you look at the kinds of opinions that are proffered on Facebook groups, they can be very accurate, real expert information to someone who just wants to put something on, quite clueless. And I think the same thing can happen if a therapist then asks a clinical question in a Facebook group. They're asking advice. They might as well just go out into the supermarket, really, and say, I've got this client, everybody, maybe get a megaphone in the middle of, you know, Tesco. Yeah. I've got this client and this is happening. Anybody can help and get people to queue up and give you an opinion. Just because people are in a Facebook group that has a title doesn't mean that they are who they say they are, you know.
Yes. And, oh, my goodness, do we go into that in the book? I think there's actually a conversation about what happened to the other editor, Gary Hibbard, who is not a therapist. He is somebody who has consulted and is part of Privacy Four in terms of from the outset. And one of the things that he did was he went into a Facebook group called Online Something for Counsellors and whatever it was. This is a long time ago. And the questions to get into the group were, are you a therapist? And he answered no. And he was still accepted.
Yeah.
Okay. So he and I sat there and he said, do you think the people who create the groups, and I know you do things differently, do you think the people who create the groups actually look at the answers? And I said, no, they're bot answers. So we had a long conversation about what can happen in these groups. And over the years, we have seen that megaphone effect because, and I am going to say, I do get people who write opinions about me as being antagonistic and provocative and pissing people off.
Okay.
Because I have challenged in these spaces and said, this is not a secure space. It's social media. Excuse me. And social media is a public environment, like you've talked about. It is the megaphone in the supermarket.
The public space,
So, well, I mean, this is the Elon Musk reference to the town hall, isn't it? What social media is. And I think there's a naivete, it's not ignorance, because most of us have been using social media for a long time now. It's a naivete about the fact that your clients may well be in those groups. Your clients may well be watching you. And how persecutory can it feel if you're asking a fairly benign question, you know, how do I work with depression? So you haven't said my client has depression, but out of the 5, 10, 15 clients that you see in a week, you might have 5, 6 of them that have a clinical diagnosis of depression, but it only needs one of those clients to see that word and go, they're talking about me, because we are egocentric.
It's true. Mm-hmm. It's true. And I think that some of the questions, I mean, I just come back to Facebook groups. Excuse me. Our Facebook group is incredibly well moderated. We have a moderator. We have all the technical tools that Meta provide to capture posts that may be off and, you know, breaking confidentiality. Mm-hmm. And actually, if a group is well run, there's a tendency for that not to happen in general. I mean, there's quite a few well-run groups. I mentioned them in the book. And they tend not to have that. But I think that some groups where they've not maybe done the training, all our staff have been, the staff who do the Facebook group have been on Meta training. and trained how to manage a Facebook group, but it is effectively the public square. Yeah. And you know, there are things that you know all therapists have difficulties, or you know, I've worked with clients and I've thought, where should I be going with this, or you know I'm not quite understanding, you know, how I should work with this client. The place to go for that is supervision.
Supervision, in capital letters. You know, that's why we have supervision.
Yeah, that's why we have supervision. And yeah. I completely get it that people get worried. You know, I'm sure a lot of people who post these questions that could identify clients, they don't do it deliberately or any malign sense of wanting to, you know, be unethical. I'm not saying that people are doing unethical. What I'm saying is that they probably do it out of A, it's convenient, and B, they want, you know, we live in a society where everybody wants an answer now. Everybody wants an answer now.
Yeah, because most of the time, I'm thinking what you're talking to there is that idea of somebody, I don't know, maybe they've just come back from shopping and, you know, they've been mulling over that day's clients. Yeah. And what we tend to do is we think, I know, I'll just ask. Because the thing about supervision is it's boundaried. Mm. It's time driven in terms of you only have it X amount of hours per month, and you have to hold and contain what's going on for you with your clients between each appointment.
Mm.
And for many people, I think, now, I don't know whether the research says this. I don't necessarily agree that it is all social media. So what I'm about to say is kind of hypocritical of my own conversations. But people do find themselves, well, I could just reach out to a Facebook group. I don't have to wait till, you know, I see Rory on Friday in 3 weeks' time, because actually I've got this question and I want it answering now. And what's interesting is I wonder what it would be like if you reached out to your supervisor and said, can I have an extra session? And I used to find my supervisees, the first thing I would say to them is, right, okay, so we have a session once every 4 weeks, 1.5 hours, 2 hours, whatever the membership body demands. That was an interesting word. Whatever the membership body recommends, I'll just change that.
Steady. The postbag will fill up.
so there's something about whatever it is that you have to do. You can reach out for extra sessions. And yes, that costs you money versus what we're talking about now, which is Facebook is free.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the issue. And, you know, there are some areas in therapy where an amount of clear knowledge, I'm going to use the word expertise, but knowledge is helpful. And when I still supervise, and there are times where you have to have quite a technical knowledge, especially, I mean, I'll give you an example, neurodivergence, which is now something that's really coming to the fore. There are times when I'm asked questions, and sometimes I have to draw on quite technical understandings of neurodivergence. You know, an example may be aphantasia, the ability not to be able to visualize. That's an example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes, I find myself saying, well, you need to check out that this person doesn't have aphantasia, because if you do mindfulness and they can't visualize, doesn't mean they've automatically got trauma. It could be that they're neurodivergent, in which case some people can't do that, in which case mindfulness wouldn't be a good intervention for this client. And the difficulty with social media, of course, it's asynchronous. You post something and then you go off and get yourself a cup of tea, and then you come back and then people respond to your post. There's no synchronous dialogue in it, so it can lose, unless you're a very good writer, and I'm not a very good writer, a very, very good, you know, writer that can write in a nuanced way, you might not get the kind of nuance and two-way communication that you get if you're in a Facebook group, if you went to see a supervisor. And also, I think any good supervisor would give half an hour free supervision if someone has an emergency. I put that in my contract. Mm-hmm. So if someone has an emergency, rather than thinking, well, you know, I'm going to have to wait, or, oh, I don't think I could afford supervision, I give them half an hour and they can phone me up Or you can send me a text and we'll book half an hour on the phone, or you know, and if it needs then to be explored in another session, at that point I'll say you're gonna have to book another session. It's as easy as that. I think most supervisors, I would hope most supervisors would build that in. Some might not, which is fine, you know, that's their practice. But it's absolutely not the place to talk about clinical work, you know, in what is effectively the town square.
Or, as you were talking, actually, one of the memories shot through my head in terms of, this is going back quite some years, where a supervisee had taken the advice from Facebook.
Yes.
And it was when you were talking about mindfulness and neurodivergent clients. They had decided to use an intervention that was advised by somebody else online, and they used it with a client who actually did have trauma, and it resulted in further trauma.
Gosh.
And when I excuse me, when I spoke to the supervisor, I was saying, so what made you try that invention? What was it that you know, made you think about bringing that into the room at that moment in time? And their answer was they'd read it in a Facebook group that, you know, this was the, because mindfulness has gone through so many rounds of being a buzzword and a buzz intervention and, you know, trauma-informed practice. And somebody had said, you know, what you get your client to do is X, Y, Z. Without that possible extra understanding, because there is so much CPD out there. There are so many memes. I mean, this is one of the things I talk about in my books, is the memetic tribe of advice that causes harm, because there are so many gurus, posts about this is what I did with my client and it was fantastic. So at the moment, this is one of the things that I've talked about with the harms to children, that they're coming across people in our profession saying to them something like, well, you know, you just need to go for a walk. That's as easy as it is, which is so dismissive of the actuality of the issue, that we've then got this professionalism about what is our duty of care? What is our Spider-Man process? You know, what is our with power comes great responsibility?
Yeah, yeah.
What do we do with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the missing piece for me is that when you work as a supervisor with a supervisee, you know them, you get to know them. And, you know, supervision is a very nuanced mechanism. It's a very delicate mechanism. And, you know, when someone asks you a question as a supervisor, and you know this yourself, there's lots of different angles, lots of different kind of optics that you look through to that question. One is, of course, you know, what's going on between the client and my supervisee? What dynamics happening there? Is there any transference or counter transference? You know, what in the supervisee's history is going to impact on working with this client? That is what good supervision is about.
Yeah.
You know, how do I feel as a supervisor about my supervisee? How do I experience the client as experienced through my supervisee? And you can't get that level of nuance in a Facebook post. Because, I mean, how many times, Kath, have we, of supervisees, it's a general observation, come to us, ask us a question. And when we work with it and we reflect together, supervisee and ourselves in the supervision space, we realize that the issue actually isn't with the client, it's with the supervisee. It's something, it's a blockage that's going on with the supervisee. This isn't a quick response on Facebook. This is, okay, well, what's going on for you? And I think there lies the danger. It's not, you know, I mean, I'll give you another great example. If you want to see what happens when people, you go into a Facebook group and entrust something to the public square, go into any car modification forums, and you'll see people who say, I want to get a little bit more speed out of my car. They end up blowing it up. You know, the pistons shoot out of the top of the block, or the wheels fall off, because someone's given some great advice that they may have been taught by their friend's hairdresser's mother's boyfriend. And, you know, if you're just in your car, you don't go on to, you know, you'd have to kind of know that person was giving you good information.
I'm just thinking that's quite hilarious, isn't it? That somebody might come in and just say, I'll just turn the talk up, you know, not knowing what they were talking about. And yeah, that's metaphorically quite hilarious.
It is, isn't it? I mean, I'm in a forum for my vehicle, and somebody said I wanted to do a lift, you know, in other words, lift the car up to put bigger wheels on. Someone did that and the wheels fell off. The steering rack collapsed. And it's like, well, you know, I did it, you know, and there's people who actually text for the car IO going, don't do that. don't do that. That's instant death.
Yeah, let's just take that metaphor for a moment, because actually there might be some neurodiversity in the audience, actually. So let's take that metaphor that with a car, the worst that's going to happen is the car stops working and you need to get a new car.
Yeah.
When we are working with people's mental health for the rest of their lives, we cannot take risks like putting bigger wheels on. We can't take risks just because, you know, that person that you referenced there, and I can't remember what the pathway was, but there was a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, we can't really do that with people that come to us implicitly trusting that we are there to help them.
Yeah.
And if we were to sit, and I'm just thinking about how this might feel for people that are listening. If your client came into the office or your supervisor and you said, okay, so here's my policies and procedures, and you handed them like a big file and you said, so that's all the data protection stuff, which it can feel quite ominous that data protection has got a lot of stuff in it. But here's my approach to social media and how I take my advice from people on the internet and the kind of training that I've had around how to engage with people on social media. So you'll be pleased to know that if I've got a problem, I'm going to go and ask a forum online. Is that okay? Mm. Can I use the words that we're discussing and pop them into a presentation? Is that okay? Can I, take your most darkest, secret, traumatizing moments and go and discuss them uptown with a megaphone in the supermarket? Is that okay? I don't think we would have clients.
No, I think we'd probably have a lot of complaints, but you wouldn't have a lot of clients. And, you know, and there's another side to this, Kath, which is safety. You know, how many times have we worked with clients who have been in fear of their lives because of their partners? We know the kind of inadequacies within the legal system when it comes to protecting people who are being stalked. I mean, there's, you know, the papers are full of people. I think Lily Allen was a classic one. It took ages before this. Lily Allen is a singer for people who might not know who she is. She's an actor now, but she was a singer and she was stalked. Someone actually went into her house. Someone broke into her house and stood at the end of her bed while she was asleep in the middle of the night. And it took ages for that to be resolved. So if you're working with someone and you're describing on a open forum in the supermarket, once for a better word, with your megaphone, what's happening, how this client is, it's possible that somebody might pick that up, have a look at it and go, I know who that is. Now, if you know who the client is and you know who the therapist is, all you've got to find out is where the therapy rooms are or where they work from. And then you've actually acquired that person. And if you want to acquire people, if you're in the business of finding out where people are, very, 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 very easy. Just go on social media.
Now, I am going to say something which I know isn't. It's only going to go to. It's only going to go so far in terms of what I discuss here. But I actually took a very an actual case of this to one of the membership bodies.
Yeah.
Because it is easy to find where a therapist's office is. It is easy because we're public services, a bit like the bank and things like that. So people do share their addresses and their addresses are known. It can be very easy to go and find who's visiting a therapist.
Yeah.
Which and I'm just thinking about safety here, when it comes to specific specialties such as sexual abuse, domestic abuse, we are talking about the safety of people who may well be maybe in witness protection.
Yep.
They may be children who have been removed from home. They may be children who are adopted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sadly, when I did take this to a membership body, they did not understand the very point that we're making right now.
Mm.
And I'm thinking this brings us quite neatly to a conversation that we've been having for quite some time now about you don't necessarily have to be putting things on social media yourselves. Your technology can do it for you. So let's talk about things that might be recording, things that might be in the room. Devices.
Yeah, so I think at this point I'm going to don my tinfoil hat, because I'm going to be talking about things that I actually can't prove, but I strongly suspect are the case. So this summer, in the heat of summer in 2023, myself and my wife went for a coffee to a local village, and we were talking about Christmas. You know, you get to sort of like July, and you're going, what are we going to do for Christmas? Mm-hmm. A typical British conversation. What are we going to do for Christmas?
The weather, Christmas, the neighbours. It's pretty much
traffic,
isn't
it? And when I got out, I have the old iPhone. And I have it switched on because I use it for navigation in the car, that type of thing. And when I got out, I was scrolling through the Facebook, and you never guess what came up: adverts for Christmas trees in July. Now. Yeah. Maybe that was just a coincidence. Maybe it was a coincidence.
No, she says, shaking her head vociferously.
Or maybe, as I put on my tinfoil hat, it may be that the app was listening for keywords that then offered advertising up. And I think we need to be very, very careful of thinking that our benign friend that we all carry around with us. We're its master. I think the thing is, it will try and master us. I'll give you another example. I was seeing a client at my therapy practice, and I got home one day, and Facebook offers up suggested friends. So these aren't people who've sought you out and requested a link. These are people who you might know, and my client came up on that list.
So we have a bit of a segue here. Actually, there is a recording of this on YouTube that I did for Manchester Institute many moons ago.
Yeah.
In terms of those GPS trackers that are on phones, because there are GPS trackers, it's a GPS device. It tracks where you are by tracking the device in alignment with the satellites.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, where do we go with this, Rory? Because, when did I write about this? It must have been about 2013, maybe 2014. So this is a decade ago. The idea of what you talked about earlier, smart shopping, has been, I'm just thinking here, I'm going to give the audience actually a book to go and read if they have about 700 hours in their life. And it's a book called Shoshana, Capital Surveillance, Surveillance Capitalism, even, by Shoshana Zuboff. I'm racking it from the top of my head here. And it actually shows how the companies, Google, Facebook, when they all began, not just Google, but all of the services, how they monitored and tracked all of the people that used their services. And from 1996, any web-based service was able to track what the customers were looking at, what was happening. And we know that this exists on websites because there are usually analytical pieces of software that will do that for you. Then there comes the comma. But many people do not know this. And a long time ago, I was talking about smart shopping because I have a slight obsession. It's called buying books. And many people know this in terms of whenever I'm talking, I can do that thing about, oh, I've read this book, I've read that book, because I just have an obsession with reading information. And I was, funnily enough, in the building I'm in now in 2009, I was buying some books for my university and therapy training course. And when I went home on my personal Facebook, there were adverts for those very books because it had synced up the email account with what I'd been searching and buying at my work computer.
Yeah.
So there wasn't even a GPS connection. It was the very fact that my email had been synced up with this particular system.
Yeah, let's talk about data brokerage and the notion that, that if you get something on the internet for free, you are the product. Mm-hmm. So if you're using any free services and you think this is really good, you're the product. In other words, you're being sold. As soon as you put your email address into that email and send it off, bearing in mind that, you know, a lot of these US companies, their data protection regulations are a lot weaker than in the UK.
They're non-existent in comparison.
In comparison, they're non-existent. And what can happen is that they sell your data. I'm doing some research for a lecture I'm giving in January this 2024 regarding the use of video platforms for telehealth. And I'm in the research process now, and I can tell you that it is frightening, absolutely frightening, what information video platforms scrape from not only you, but from the client. You know,
do we need a warning at this part of the? I'm just thinking we've got into devices, and I've just realised I've done that thing where I've talked about 2009 and how we were being tracked. What I do want to do is I might even put this in the show notes underneath, like, at how many minutes have we doing? At 45 minutes in, it gets scary, right?
Yeah, it gets scary.
Because we actually do have data protection laws within the EU and UK. However, Rory, you're exactly right. I have a funny feeling you're talking about one of them that begins with B.
Yes.
And many of the platforms, so in the book that's coming out, there's a fantastic chapter. It's my favorite chapter in the entire book, and I am just going to lean on this for a second. All about privacy rights and freedoms.
Yeah.
Because that discipline isn't being talked about in our profession enough, which is why I brought one of the leading voices around privacy rights and freedoms. And when you read her chapter about the ad trackers and the way that data is being scraped, that's the one that I should put a warning on, saying this is the horror chapter.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and we are into the scary stuff territory here, because there are people called data brokers. You know, people they sell and buy information, and they're legitimate companies. They pay their taxes. They're legitimate companies, and they buy and sell data. And I'm just doing some research into one, which will be in my lecture, and they are, I think, at the moment a $5 billion company. Let that sink in.
It's the one with B. Yes.
It's the one with B. $5 billion. That would buy me a fair few tea bags, I can tell you, Kath. Yes. And their job is to scrape data. You could go to them and you could say, tell me everything you know about this or a demographic of individuals, and they will produce absolute detail for you. Absolute detail.
And they publicly announce it.
Yeah, they publicly announce it. Yeah, they publicly announce it.
So what? So what we're really saying is, at this point, when we talk about technology, and I will say this is the thing that I've been banging on about for a long time, and this is the thing that I've upset many professionals in our profession. This is because I've used words like things are not safe, when what I actually mean is cybersecurity safe, data protection safe, privacy safe. And the difference between safety in a therapy office. So I'm actually sitting in my office at the minute that I leave all the devices in, because I actually have my therapy room to the side. So there's this distinction between where anything that can listen sits, and then the room in which I actually sit with people, where I offer a confidential space, because in that space, there's a barrier between the device and the person I'm with. So we'll come to that in just a second. But any of the platforms at this point in time, and with Privacy 4, which is the company that we've kind of rounded up everybody into doing the book for, we have a number of people from the information security sector, the information governance sector, the cybersecurity sector, the privacy sector, the data protection sector. These are whole disciplines within themselves, because they are vast, they are complicated, they do overlap each other, but pretty much it's all about protecting the people that we are going to be working with. Mm. And many of these platforms have one aspect box ticked all the way down. So it might be GDPR compliance, for example, but they often lack something in the region of the privacy rights and freedoms domain, because to understand everything means that they've got to have people coming in. And there are spaces where Privacy4 does recommend some platforms, and we might say, yep, in a information governance perspective, they do manage their data well. You know, they've got ISO 27001 certification, which is really, it's a simple policy that helps people understand how to keep data safe, including people who might be in and around the building. So the building I'm in has cleaners. So I have what's known as a clear desk policy. It's written up within all of my data protection policies, because I am that nerd. And that means that I don't leave anything out that the cleaners could see, that could identify anybody that's in my practice. Now, it does bode for the arguments that I have when I go in and out of services, where I might be seeing somebody that could be a client or a customer where I'm offering a confidential service and I have to sign the fire register.
Yeah.
So, you know, I get into pickles and fights with a lot of people saying I'm not signing it, because that will identify me with that client if I write in who I'm coming to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, slight tangent there. So devices, yes. We, for a long, long time, well, actually, this is what Shoshana Zabrof writes about, is how that data has been scraped, how that data has been mined. And I can tell you, I'm worth £6.26 on the dark net, by the way. I just thought I'd let you know. So I'm not worth that much.
There you have it. I'll stick that on your website.
£6.26, or is it $6.26 at the moment? Yeah. And that is all of my personal information, which has been scraped over the years because of perhaps where I've signed up for a company and then there was a data breach and my data was leaked. Yeah. So it's not even my doing.
Mm. Mm.
So, yeah. So yeah. I'm just thinking devices. Should we talk about devices in the room or?
Yes, well, I think
should we leave that for your podcast?
Yes, if you want to hear me and Kath talk about devices in the room, then come over to the Counselling Tutor podcast on iTunes, and I dare say that interview will go out probably December of 2023. But yes, we're going to have a long discussion about that. But I think the point for me is the impact on clients. So if we know that our devices scrape data and we can find data, if I'm being offered up as a friend to my clients on my phone, there's a very good chance that my client will be offered me as their friend on their phone.
Yes.
Now that could lead to someone who isn't technologically savvy looking and going, oh, he wants to friend me. So they click on, client friends me, and then there's that conversation of, oh, I'll notice you friend me, and if that's in your policy, that's fine, but it might be that certainly clients have got attachment issues.
Yes,
and they come along and they go, well, he's not friending me. You know, you might have to sit and explain, you know, what that is, and you know, for those people listening out there, I think, well, you know, it sounds a bit X-Files, Kath and Rory stories. You know, no one's really tried to acquire clients. I can tell you that I came back from my practice a couple of three years ago, just before COVID, shall we say, and I sat down with my cup of tea and the phone went and I picked my phone up and I said, hello, Rory, and this voice said, oh, hello, how are you? And I'm like, yeah, could you tell me if my husband came for therapy today? And I said, I couldn't tell you even if he did. I said, because he's entitled to, whoever your husband is, is entitled to confidentiality. And this person pushed and pushed and pushed. And I said, I don't know who you are, because they hid their phone number.
Yeah.
I said, but I cannot confirm or deny any of my clients. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to bring this conversation to an end. And that isn't unusual. And when I work for offender services, I met a number of individuals who were in the probation services view dangerous. When someone's dangerous, that means really dangerous. And I was giving housing advice. I wasn't a probation officer, I have to say. I was a housing advice person linked to a charity I worked at. And I had someone who had committed, shall we say, the worst crimes towards their children. And the first question this person asked me when he sat down was, can you tell me where my wife and kids are? And every time I saw this person, saw him three times, he would ask the same question. And he would ask the question of that's all he was interested in. He was like a malevolent Terminator. He just wanted to acquire his wife and children. And he was trying everybody. He was trying absolutely everybody. And, you know, when you've got clients who are seeking therapy, you know, who are estranged from their partners or frightened because there may be gang-related incidents, you have to take privacy as a matter of literally life and death. You really do have to. And, you know, thinking about what you talk about on social media groups, how you present yourself, even down to the fact of thinking about your location. You know, you're right. Signing people into a guest book. When I was a sales rep many years ago, before I honed my moral compass, one of the things I would do was I would go into a business and I would go through the get when someone was going to get the person. I'd go through the register, see who'd signed in. Was it a competitor?
Well, in terms of let's think about your morals. We're going to have a separate discussion about that.
My moral compass is a lot more. I wasn't in the same space now. I've developed a lot.
I am just thinking, actually, it's really pertinent to child therapists, child and adolescent therapists, if we talk about this for a moment. Actually, you need to consider your data protection policies.
Yeah.
Also include you visiting children at schools and what you do in terms of registers, attendance, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I am just going to say any of that information, come to us at Privacy for Us. I'm doing my podcast here. This isn't about Privacy for, but come to us at Privacy for that information, and definitely buy the book.
Yeah.
But I wanted to just alert people to two things that when you talked about the GPS, and if you are working with a client who is in a domestic abuse situation, or a client who, let's just take a young person who might be coming to you about their sexuality, their gender, some sort of difficulty that they're having, and their parents do not know that you are seeing them, and they then go home and your face pops up in terms of friends that you may know, that could actually alert people to a conversation which could result in a violent outcome.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this isn't, whilst we're joking a little bit in terms of the signing in registers, actually this can have a real life impact. And this is why I'm so concerned about it, because this is going back to that word you talked about earlier, safety. Mm. This is about you as a professional are responsible for protecting your clients when they come to your service.
Mm.
So, you know, whether that's domestic abuse service, whether you're a counsellor, whether you are criminal justice system, you have this responsibility that comes with the professional title. And when we are doing this job, yes, I get it. It is scary. It is overwhelming. I totally understand that when, you know, digital and technology is not your thing. And I am going to say, and it has to be your thing.
Yeah.
So one of the recommendations that's gone out in a cybersecurity article that I've done with a cybersecurity professional and a neuroscientist, because we all have a vested interest in what's currently happening with data, what's currently happening with people using those spaces. We've made a recommendation that training, and this is the first recommendation out of a list of seven, all therapy and psychology and any kind of service that provides mental health support, talking therapies, must, and we are making it a must, I know it's a very direct, critical parent language, must have training in data protection and cybersecurity. It's no longer an option to pretend to be a technophobe.
No. I'm afraid we're living in an epoch of technology. And it's even more scary. It's even more scary than that. I recently bought a new Pocket Spy, as I like to call my iPhone. And I was going through setting it up, and I discovered quite an interesting setting. I can give my wife my location. I can opt to send her my location. And I switched it on. And my wife said, what's this? I said, you can find out where I am. And she said, I don't know where you are. See enough of you. But it's a little window into our relationship. And I switched it on first. I said, can I switch yours on? Because I want to. Now, the thing is, if I knew her password, I could have switched that on without her consent. And let me tell you what that gives me. That gives me a map when I turn it on. And on that map is a little square with my wife's lovely face on. And I can tell down to about 10 square meters where she is when she's got a phone with her.
Yep.
Now, if that was, you know, and people who are coercive, people who give coercive control, I mean, that's just the easy ones. There are some tracking apps that will track phone conversations. So you can put that on. It will record the conversation, send it to the cloud. In other words, store it externally from the phone on a website. Password, and you can access it. So when someone's phoning up, you can listen to what's being said. And these things are easily searchable. You know, and if you've got someone who is a controlling, malevolent force in someone's life, and you know that person is fear, the client is fearful of the life from that person, that device can tell someone where they are, and it doesn't take much. So you find out where they are, then you just Google the building, find out who's in the building, and you find it's therapy, and you know.
And to give you, I'm not going to go off and really terrify people at the end. This is the world I've worked in with the cyber security and cyber criminal conversations that we've had over many, many years. Given that there is now a map that will give you a 3x3 square around the world called What Three Words, you can actually pinpoint. And I've done this on MOD property, actually, which should not have been allowed, but it was. I have actually tracked a person on an MOD property, and I can see which side of the building they were in because it's a 3x3 meter square. This technology is incredible in terms of what it allows us to do, but it's also incredible in how it can be misused against us. So
absolutely.
I think what I would suggest is if people really want to understand the devices in the therapy room, that's a conversation we're going to do for counselling tutor in a moment. So what I will say is buy the book. If you are a therapist or psychotherapist, go and do the training. Like you've got some at counselling tutor, Rory, go and do the training around some of this technology. Certainly, if you want to understand the data protection, cybersecurity stuff, come to Privacy 4, because that is what we do. And I'm going to use a phrase from Gary right at the end here that actually, and he talks about cybersecurity, but I'm going to talk about technology training. Put technology training on the agenda before it becomes the agenda.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, Rory, for your time today in this conversation. I think we've left people hanging with, oh, my God, what do I do? What do I do? There are solutions. Go find them. Counselling tutor, Privacy 4, read the book. Go do some more training. It currently isn't adequate enough for our profession. And I will say that professionally. That is in my book, Left, Right and Centre. It's in all of the journal articles that I'm doing at the moment with people. And I will be having another conversation with the Mental Health VR Coalition, which is an international coalition, and I'm part of the International XRSI Coalition, because technology is getting faster, technology is changing where we're doing the therapy, and right now we're just talking about handheld things and Web 2.0.
Yeah.
So there's lots more conversations to come on the podcast as it is, but thank you for your time so far.
Well, thank you for taking the time to interview me. And as it always, Kathy, ploughing that new ground. So it's always been a joy to speak to you. And of course, to your listeners. Thank you.
Thanks.